You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Europe's leaders are arguing about who will pay for what in the next 7 years. We ask if the EU finance summit looks more and more like an argument over a housekeeping budget. We'll have journalists in both France and Spain.
Spain in this current context is simply looking to at least maintain its current share of certain funds.
And is it too soon to be singing the praises of Mohamed Morsi, the diplomat? We'll ask how the Egyptian president successfully brokered the Israel-Gaza ceasefire. And we'll also be joined in the studio by our culture editor, Robert Bound, who'll be raising the tone with a selection of what's in the latest edition of Monocle magazine.
I'll be telling you a little bit, Emma, about what the French press talks about when it talks about the French press, and I'll be showing you some sexy Asian cinemas.
Can't wait. We'll play you some great music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Triumphal Hamas celebrated what they called a victory in Gaza today after a truce was declared last night with Israel. The brutal 8-day conflict has killed 162 Palestinians and 5 Israelis. With a truce now at its 24th hour, political analyst Amos Azael said that actually it was the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu who emerged victorious, certainly in political terms.
Benjamin Netanyahu emerges as a winner, not so much in terms of the international system, but in terms of the Israeli system, because this was the first time in his cumulative 6 years as prime minister, the first time that he actually led Israel into battle. And the general way in which he conducted this was consensual, very consensual, and also cautious. In other words, he ultimately avoided the big adventure that was plausible and that many demanded of him to embark on.
European Union leaders are gathering in Brussels today to seek a deal on the Eurozone's 7-year budget. Many, like Britain, are calling for cuts in line with the savings they're making nationally. The Finnish Prime Minister Jyrki Kaitanen wanted to reach out to the UK, saying a deal was needed for all 27 members of the bloc.
We have to deal with the UK and we need a whole budgetary deal. And I do hope that we could find a solution which is suitable for UK also, because now we are building budgets for EU27, so we need a UK in.
But the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, says he thinks the United Kingdom's negotiating position puts chances of a compromise on the European budget in doubt.
First of all, I have some doubts if a compromise is possible today, because the last informations I got, the intransigent position of Prime Minister Cameron, the position of the UK government, take it or leave it, this is not the beginning of a negotiation, this is more or less a kind of ultimatum. So I think that will be very difficult.
An anti-poverty campaigner has become Kenya's first openly gay man to run for political office, but David Kuria Mboti faces a challenging path as he tries to dispel taboos in the largely conservative Christian nation in a race for a Senate seat. If elected, he would be Africa's only openly homosexual black man to hold national office. Staying with African news, and the International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Ivory Coast's former First Lady Simone Gbagbo, accusing her of crimes against humanity committed during the West African nation's post-election conflict last year. The warrant alleges she was criminally responsible for murder, rape, other forms of sexual violence, other inhumane acts and persecution. Clashes erupted today between students and police in the Chilean capital Santiago. Some protesters hurled rocks and objects at police, while others scrambled to avoid the violence. Several arrests were made. Students have led regular protests for over a year now, calling for wide-ranging educational reforms. And finally, for those seeking a glow to their Christmas this year, a jewellery store in downtown Tokyo has just the answer. A pure gold revolving tree-like ornament, which is made of 40 kilograms or 88 pounds of pure gold, standing nearly 8 feet high and 4 feet in diameter. It's decorated with pure gold plate silhouette cutouts of 50 popular Disney characters, including Cinderella and Mickey Mouse, and draped with ribbons made of gold leaf. And it costs a mere $4.2 million. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. The time is 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se che che che.
From London,
London, cara.
This is Monocle 24.
It is supposed to offer the EU some certainty, to fix a seven-year budget and to decide the contributions made by each member state. But the special budget summit in Brussels has arguably highlighted the fact that despite a show of unity, Europe's nations all have very different outlooks and agendas. This year, unsurprisingly, things are particularly fraught. With most countries facing domestic budgetary cuts, a spirit of protectionism has arisen. Well, we'll look at the broader context in just a moment, but first let's hear from two of the countries who have a particular point to make. Let's head to Paris first and talk to Marcus Carlsson from France 24. Welcome to Midori House, Marcus. The issue here is always going back to French protectionism and agriculture. Perhaps no great surprise here.
Absolutely no great surprise. Obviously, France has a very delicate balance to strike in these budget negotiations. At the same time as the country doesn't want to see the EU's budget grow, it also wants to keep its share of the common agricultural policy. Now, France is the biggest recipient of agricultural subsidies, which make up around about 40% of the European Union's budget. And obviously, Paris wants to keep hold of that money.
Paris, it appears, is also going after the British. I'm looking at a copy of Le Monde from Thursday, and it has a three-page special on how David Cameron is basically making trouble for absolutely everybody. This is almost exposing fault lines here, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, David Cameron is being painted as the main culprit in the French press, if you will. Little attention is being spent on the fact that other countries like Sweden, like Netherlands, and like Denmark and Finland also want to see the European Union's budget frozen or cut down even. As you say, David Cameron is really being painted here in black colours. He is the main problem, if you will, for Brussels and for Paris, especially so from a common agricultural policy perspective as well, because Britain has been pushing hard to actually reform the so-called CAP and decrease the amount of money being spent on the CAP each year.
François Hollande has just arrived in Brussels, and he's trying to be seen to be taking a more considered stance on this one. I mean, in the past, he has gone head-to-head with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel in terms of austerity versus investment. But he has said in the last few hours that Europe is a compromise, not a series of individual interests. I'm here to find a consensus with the help of Germany. Could France now be the go-between in all this?
I suppose it could be, but once again, it all comes back to the common agricultural spending. Whether or not the other countries will push harder to cut down on that common agricultural spending, because if indeed they choose to do so, then France could be drawing some red lines on itself. And François Hollande doesn't want that. He was elected on a platform of growth, and he's pledged to boost growth, and he says that the EU's budget, including agricultural subsidies, is part of that and should be part of boosting growth.
Marcus Carlsson from France 24, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now we head to Madrid to talk to Miles Johnson, who's a financial journalist in Spain. Miles, we've just been listening to the French situation. With Spain, they are committed to austerity on the home front. Surely from this budget summit, they're going to try and take what they can get.
Yes, I certainly think that's true. I mean, I think in Spain, the position is slightly more complicated in the sense it has to be weighed against their overall diplomatic position within the European Union as it stands. obviously, Spain currently does receive quite a lot of money from the European Union. It receives, you know, agricultural subsidies and other forms of funds. But at the same time, I don't think this is the time for the government of Mariano Rajoy to be rocking the boat considerably when within the next 6 months his government could be requesting an international bailout from the European Union.
Surely as well, they know that there is less money to go around nowadays.
Well, certainly. Again, I think, you know, probably the same position as many other countries. I think the government here would be rather loath to increase its own contributions, but would probably be rather keen to keep what it's currently receiving, whilst at the same time keeping its head sort of below the parapet. I don't think we're going to see any large bust-ups involving Spain in these negotiations.
Miles Johnson, financial journalist in Spain, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Let's head now to Frankfurt and talk to Michael Steen from the Financial Times, the Frankfurt bureau chief there. Michael, to get a little bit more context on these talks, the budget is a place where the leaders generally show their true colours. Schisms are revealed. This year there is a concentration of feeling though, isn't there?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, this only happens every 7 years, and you've got every country potentially wielding a veto and every country wanting to protect a certain part of what was there before. So it's always a very fraught process. And as you said in your introduction, it's just that much worse this year because we're in the middle of a financial crisis. Everyone is cutting their national budgets. So this means that there's so much more to fight over at the European level, and that's why you've seen these calls, particularly from the northern countries, to cut the budget, and you've got other parts of the EU wanting to preserve bits for them, like in Eastern Europe, where these cohesion funds are important, or France, where it's the agricultural policy, or the south, where they also want more aid projects to carry on.
We're looking across all the media that's coming out, and everybody seems to be focusing on the British Prime Minister David Cameron and his threat to use his veto. Perhaps an example of a country's leader looking to appease domestic political groupings and taking that agenda to the international stage. Is there generally a need for not necessarily a hate figure, but someone around whom all the discord can be focused?
It's certainly interesting, as you say, that the focus is very much on Cameron. That's partly his own doing, but also here in Germany, the coverage is focused on Cameron, and you have like the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung writing about the British and their endless wrestling with Brussels. I think that, a lot of this is coming from Cameron himself. He's laid down some fairly tough demands because he has the Eurosceptic wing of the Conservative Party on his back. So the problem is, of course, that Cameron has already wielded a veto once, so he's left himself without any real natural allies amongst the other 26 members of the EU, and it could all get very, very tense. I mean, there's diplomats apparently talking about this summit being a so-called three-shirter, which means that they should all pack three shirts because that's how many they'll need to change before we see the end of it.
You mentioned there the fact that David Cameron doesn't seem to have an ally, but just returning to this article in Le Monde, which we were mentioning a moment ago, there is a line saying that Merkel and Cameron are almost allied on austerity, and it's the likes of François Hollande who's pushing for more growth who might be the difficult player in this. Is any of the German media now covering the fact that Merkel and Cameron are in principle coming from the same position?
That will be there too, but because David Cameron is the obvious person who's going to cause a bust up here, that's why the focus has been on him. If you look at the some of the pre-summit coverage, if you look at what the British were demanding, that the budget for over 7 years is about €1 trillion, and I think the Commission's proposal was to come up with something like just below 1.1 trillion for those 7 years. Cameron has said he wants it to be frozen at 2011 levels, which would roughly mean about €866 billion. And the Germans come in between that. Their proposal was €960 billion. So that shows you that certainly the Germans, if you look at the facts, are a lot closer to the British. But I think there's the mood music is just one of there's beginning to be a sense of exasperation amongst many other Europeans about the British position when it comes to these summits and coming to agreements. So, you know, there is, however, it should also be said, I mean, we may get a deal, and there have been a few hopeful signs today of that, but it's certainly a no foregone conclusion.
No, you say that, and Angela Merkel has been quoted today as saying that there may not actually be an agreement on this at this summit. Looking at previous summits, if there were no agreement, what would this actually mean?
Well, what they're actually trying to agree on is the budget from 2014 to 2020. So obviously that's still a year away. Now, and it is interesting that the Germans do seem to have been briefing that it won't be such a tragedy if there is no agreement by the weekend, and that there's still time. Now, technically, there is still a year to go. However, I think the problem with that is that to get a lot of the projects up and running upon which this which need this budget money for, you need to legislate, and normally that process takes about a year. Added to that, next year you've got German elections and other things like that, so that whilst it's certainly true that there's essentially another year to go, and maybe we won't have an agreement, and maybe somehow they'll reconvene, it begins to get a bit more difficult. It's not that there's been a great deal recently, obviously, in the Eurozone crisis of kicking the can down the road, and I suppose we might see a bit more of that in the next few hours. But there will be people who then become nervous that you then won't have an agreement. And in fact, if you don't get an agreement, what happens is the budget is frozen at the 2013 level, which would actually be a defeat, really, for Mr. Cameron, because that would make the budget higher than he wants it to be, and that would be presentationally difficult for him to take back to London.
Michael Steen from the Financial Times in Frankfurt, thank you very much indeed for coming on the show. And my thanks also to Marcus Carlson in Paris and Miles Johnson in Madrid. The time is just nudging 17 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. We stay in Europe now. Here's a song from one of France's new stars, Zaz, and J'aime à nouveau. Des rafales d'émotions envahissaient me sous les illusions. En fait perdre l'argent du monde. Je du monde. L'enjeu. The Parisian singer Zaz there and J'aime à nouveau. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is 21 minutes past the hour. Stay with us, because next we'll examine the Egyptian president's sudden emergence as the hero of the day in the Israel-Hamas conflict.
This Christmas, Monocle invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co, and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
As more and more governments demand cuts in public spending, design and healthcare is viewed more often than not as an unaffordable luxury. But design-savvy Denmark, not surprisingly, recognizes the curative potential of good design.
If you should look at the outcome for the patients, you should really think about the design, about the inclusion of nature, about the inclusion of organic materials, because it really lifts the patients.
Monocle Films drops in on a hospice that feels more like a home. Broadcasting now on monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House. Now, he once called Israel a bunch of vampires. So how is Egypt's President Mohamed Morsi suddenly being heralded as a pioneering peacemaker? If anything can be agreed upon in the Gaza-Israel conflict, it must surely be the leading role played by Egypt, shoulders to shoulder perhaps with the US, in bringing about the current truce. So should we already be placing wagers for Mohamed Morsi to be the next recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, or are we getting a little ahead of ourselves? Well, to discuss this, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by David Shanker from the Washington Institute. He joins me on the line. Now, David, have you been impressed by Mohamed Morsi?
Well, until now, no. But this is really an impressive thing that he did. Of course, he's one of the few people that could have done this, being in the position of being, you know, a senior official, basically, in the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt, and Hamas being the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so who else could talk to both Hamas and Israel? And he did, you know, I think what was an impressive and the right thing to do.
Were you expecting him to be this effective, though? Because people are already saying that had Mubarak been in the role, this would never have happened.
Well, I think that's right. Morsi was particularly well placed. I hadn't really had very high expectations of him, to tell you the truth. You know, this is a guy who hadn't mentioned the word Israel until this conflict, when he mentioned it in the context of Israeli aggression. And so he's no lover of Israel, and I think will look to downgrade the Egyptian peace treaty with Israel without breaking it. But this was, you know, something that he wanted to do very much. In particular, because Egypt's foreign policy in the last decade of Mubarak had become really, you know, stagnant. It was not a significant regional actor in any regard, and in fact, it couldn't even intimidate a state like Rwanda or Tanzania into giving Egypt its traditional quota of Nile water.
He has, in fact, played quite a clever campaign in terms of foreign policy, hasn't he? And in August, he started to tentatively reach out to Iran and other regional powers, including Saudi Arabia and in Turkey, in an initiative to try and sort the problem or address the issues in Syria. He's also chose China as his first destination for an overseas trip. Are we seeing the emergence of a global political figure here?
Well, let's not get out ahead of ourselves. This is one thing that Morsi did. We still have to remember that this is a state with, you know, 30 to 40% unemployment. 40 to 50% of the people there make less than $2 a day. Its foreign reserves are down to less than $10 billion, down from, you know, $36 billion at the time of the revolution. This is not a state with great economic prospects, and it while he may be interested in raising his own profile and the profile of that of Egypt and the Arab world and the Middle East, you know, that's fine and good. But if he's got all these problems at home, he won't be in power indefinitely.
So given the fact that you mentioned that Egypt is mired in financial trouble, not to sound too cynical, but how much influence do you think that the loan agreed by the IMF of nearly $5 billion may have acted as a little sweetener for Mr. Morsi to get things going?
I think he's, you know, acutely aware of Egypt's financial predicament. You know, he had a 100-day plan when he first came into office, saying that he was going to, you know, end pollution in Cairo and end traffic. And these are really ambitious goals, and they didn't really get very far on any of them. Certainly he knows, though, that the financial largesse of the world for Egypt will in large part be based on the maintenance of the peace treaty with Israel. But something like this certainly helps Morsi's position when he's going to look for this kind of cash influx.
How is this also being viewed from elsewhere within the Middle East? Obviously, Israel is having to come to terms with the fact that Hamas is getting increasing legitimacy in terms of the negotiation process. But also, Are they watching what happened and where Egypt stands now in terms of their future relationship with the country?
Yeah, I think that they were, Israel was pleasantly surprised by this. And not only President Obama has been praising Mohamed Morsi, but the Israelis are quite pleased, particularly given that, just in, what was it, September of 2011, when the peace treaty with Egypt was on the brink. Literally, Morsi didn't take steps until, the Tantawi at the time, the Minister of Defense at the time, didn't take steps to prevent the storming of the Israeli embassy, and six Israeli diplomats were almost killed, and that could have really ended the peace with Egypt. This is a surprisingly good development, but we also have to keep in mind that what Morsi did and how he did it, as you said, raised the profile and the stature of Hamas regionally. They had all these Arab foreign ministers there, and this all comes at the expense of Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, which is the sort of more moderate Israeli peace partner. If they're ever going to make a peace treaty between Palestinians and Israelis, it's going to be between the PLO, Mahmoud Abbas, et cetera, those guys who are controlling the West Bank, and not with Hamas. And so this really, while it quiets the situation, it is a huge setback for potential peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
Which leads me to my last question, David. Morsi is being lauded at the moment for bringing immediate and very fragile ceasefires about. The bigger task now is the regional negotiations. How do you think that is going to play out?
Well, Egypt has to do something, and Morsi has to do something that I think is pretty abhorrent to him, which is he's got the great, the benefit of being able to be the person who opened up Gaza. But he has to end the movement of heavy weapons to Hamas in Gaza. This is something that Egypt hasn't done. Morsi has not secured the Sinai. It's loaded with militants and terrorists, and Al-Qaeda is taking root there. And these people are moving into Gaza and passing on these heavy weapons that actually made this campaign possible, weapons from Sudan, weapons from Libya, etc. If Morsi doesn't take care of this problem, then this is going to be a very fragile and short-lived the truce, to be sure, and it's unclear whether even after this type of agreement that he brokered and the significant benefits that he gets and the Muslim Brotherhood gets politically, whether he's willing to take this very difficult political step of preventing Hamas from rearming.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. David Schenken from the Washington Institute, thank you very much indeed for joining us. The time is just 31 minutes past the hour. Stay with us, because in the next half hour of the programme, we'll find out how some of the more notable outcomes from the Monocle Soft Power Survey, and we'll find out what's making our culture editor tick in this month's Monocle.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. Time now to get the latest world news headlines from Jonathan.
Thank you very much. Triumphal Hamas celebrated what they called a victory in Gaza today, 24 hours after a truce was declared last night with Israel. The brutal eight-day conflict has killed 162 Palestinians and five Israelis. European Union leaders are gathering in Brussels to seek a deal on the Eurozone's seven-year budget. Many, like Britain, are calling for cuts in line with the savings they're making nationally. But the President of the European Parliament said the UK's negotiating position puts chances of a compromise on the European budget in doubt. An anti-poverty campaigner has become Kenya's first openly gay man to run for political office, but David Kuria Mbote faces a challenging path as he tries to dispel taboos in the largely conservative Christian nation in a race for a Senate seat. Staying with African news, the International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Ivory Coast's former First Lady Simone Gbagbo, accusing her of crimes against humanity. And clashes have erupted yet again between students and police in the Chilean capital, Santiago. Students have led regular protests for over a year now, calling for wide-ranging educational reforms. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from London. Now, with the latest edition of Monocle out this week, gracing the shelves of your local bookstore of note, and my hand as well. Every day this week, we on Midori House are drawing your attention to some of the stories inside the magazine. Today, we're joined by our culture editor, Robert Bound, who will be talking us through some of the highlights.
Hi, Emma.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I guess at this time, previous days this week, some of our editors have come downstairs and talked about the different lead stories in the section on this Soft Power December-January issue. It's a bumper double issue. That's almost the most Freudian of all possible slips. I would never say that about the magazine.
Never. Not on live radio anyway. Certainly not.
I'm going to turn it from dumper into bumper really quickly, okay? We had these round table things, which are a radio thing, which we'll be able to enjoy over Christmas, and obviously took place in the magazine as well. And in the culture section, we looked at the media, we looked at the press, and we looked at it through the prism of the French press, which is a sort of interesting one because she sort of think it's not quite as free as it would like to be. In fact, one of the commentators in that piece says we're the 40th most free press in the world, which is kind of surprising, isn't it?
It is a little bit surprising. It is one of those strange places, though, that everybody, like you say, gives the impression that it is free. But I think there's such tight controls in terms of the number of people who live and work within the French media, that it's an entirely closed shop. And I think this is borne out in the article, isn't it?
Yes, this is a really good thing. We had four people talking with one of our Monocle 24 hosts as well, Tom Burgess Watson, who moderated this chat. Aude Baron, who's the editor of Le Plus, which is a French magazine. Harold Hyman, who's from BFM TV, which is a business TV station and a radio station in Paris. René Kaplan, who's a Franco-American author. She used to be at France 24 as their editorial director of English speaking services, and Olivier Royon, who everyone will know probably as the editor-in-chief at Paris Match, the most famous of the names there. And so they kind of chewed the fat, really, about a year in the international press and a year in terms of the French press as well. The most newsworthy thing for them, of course, was the election of François Hollande over Sarkozy and what this meant. And as you've read from the piece as well, and we've kind of ticked off a few things to talk about, they're all kind of a bit disappointed. Not necessarily that they would have voted for Sarkozy themselves, but as news editors, as news people, Hollande is so much less interesting to talk about than Sarkozy.
So it's an interesting thing. His girlfriend has managed to go and get herself slap bang into the middle of all the trouble.
Yeah.
And he's actually being told by Carla Bruni to just calm it down a little bit.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which actually made me very, very surprised, given the
always fact that take advice on chilling out from Carla.
Absolutely. But Carla was an absolute tease when she was in the Elysee Palace. She was like, don't look at my baby, don't look at my baby. I'm Carla Bruni, by the way. Don't ever forget that. And there was always this real come hither, no step back approach from Madame Bruni. There's also this difficult path that the French media often has to take. I'm thinking when François Mitterrand was exposed as having had an illegitimate son, that everyone went, yeah, of course. What? Whereas were that to take place in so many other countries, it would cause an enormous scandal in terms of an individual's ability to govern and an individual's ability to be honest with both his family and the people. The French shrugged their shoulders. The illegitimate son turned up at Mitterrand's funeral and everyone just went home and had a glass of wine, didn't worry about it. And this is borne out here as well.
Exactly. And it is that thing as well, when it comes to, as you mentioned, Mitterrand's illegitimate son, there's that thing. Also, the ruling class kind of have a different rule about them. And I feel that this is something that is only happening, I don't know whether it'll happen or not, but Leveson's findings happen in the UK on Thursday
next
this week. So we'll see what happens with that. But it's something that there is a sort of there's an unwritten rule in French journalism, which seems to be there is an element of politeness or an element of doff capping towards the ruling classes that you absolutely don't get.
Perhaps for fear that they will be exposed themselves.
Well, yeah, exactly. I know.
Still people in glass houses.
Yeah, I guess there is always that element. But that's a really good piece, and that's going to be on the radio as well during our Christmas period, Tom Burgess Watson's thing. Another thing, David Michon went to Munich. He seems to love going to Munich. He's kind of on a piece of elastic that just goes to Munich and pings back to London.
He returned and I asked him what it was like to go into, you know, proper Bavaria. And he looked at me with a really sort of softened expression on his face, like, really nice.
Yeah, it's kind of an.
He likes Bayern.
Yeah,
David.
Yeah, right. And this is sort of a nice soft story coming out of Bavaria. This is a retirement home for interesting creative people, Germans and Münchers. Although some of them, one of the ladies, handsome lady, who's or handsome
what
for
page
her
is
age.
A handsome lady on?
This is page 140/141. It's good, isn't it? It's like being in the office, but on the radio. What are we doing? Are we doing that? Have you got? Did you get
it's
my text?
It's like being in church.
Yeah,
so
it's good, isn't
now
it?
Turn to page 141. There's a handsome German lady. she's a terribly handsome lady. We're talking about the handsome redheaded lady.
Yeah.
Actually,
no,
there's three handsome ladies on page 141.
I'll tell you what I like. One page 139.
Listeners, you must be gripped by this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Should we do a flick book?
Yeah, go on.
Should we pass each other notes?
Yes.
But this is a cool thing. This is this is basically a retirement home funded by a newspaper whose money came from also being a circus. It's a very bizarre story. But anyway, these people have come to this place, and it's this kind of groovy hangout for people that pay rent.
It's almost like a cultural co-op, isn't it?
It's kind of like that place in Copenhagen where people wash and they're old. You know, that kind
yes,
of commune.
Yeah, like and that. The people where people wash. And they're incredible. What's delightful about this is that it affords, as you can tell from the photographs and from the piece that David has written, that it affords people a lot of dignity who perhaps otherwise in other cultures might have been slightly abandoned.
Well, they've got all their own gear in here, and it's a kind of beautiful place. I mean, the photographer, who is Jens Schwarz, has done an amazing job on this, but I think all these people kind of, it's a pretty cool place. These people are also allowed to, these people are still writing film reviews and editing film scripts and doing all the work that they used to do, or a lot of them are doing a proportion of the work they used to in their 80s. And I guess their life and their interest is prolonged by being part of this kind of creative community where certainly a percentage of their rent is paid for by this organisation that puts them up.
One
so
wonders.
They still have to have a bit of, they have to have had some stuff put away, but I think they still work. So it's kind of it's a cool thing.
One wonders, although Germany would be very good at creating sort of harmonious communal places, one wonders if they ever have a good falling out.
I bet they do.
Because if you have put a bunch of creatives, regardless of their age, into the same place and make them all live together, one can only imagine that it's going to be fireworks.
I'm telling you who I wouldn't want to pick a fight with.
Which one's that one?
Hans Ruby.
Where's
picture
he?
7, page 141. Look
it's
at him.
Page 141, ladies and gentlemen, picture 7.
See, that man. The man in the circle.
Oh, I don't know. I think he'd be the peacemaker. It's
really?
Number 10, ladies and gentlemen, who I'm a little bit
Stop
scared of.
Stop doing the numbers. People won't like it. So there's that. So that's a very groovy thing. We also do this thing every December, January. We do this kind of cultural calendar thing. We do a diary thing. This year, we decided to switch it up a little bit, and we've got sort of some recommendations from some of our favourite people that you might hear on Monocle 24, musicians like Lindstrom and Oland from Norway and Denmark, and Elif Safak, a novelist from Turkey, kind of telling you what they're going to be curling up to with at Christmas.
Yes,
in
I'm,
terms of books and music, not necessarily people.
I like that. Well, they might have done, they might not have
decided to tell
you.
I'll tell you what I've got my eye on.
That's another.
Is this a different show?
That's a separate supplement.
Okay.
I quite like this change in direction because you get a more complete view of what people's interests are. I mean, looking at Oland, she gives us loads of music, but then she decides what she's going to be reading. This is Jack London, Klondike Tales. And then Asif Kapadia Sena is a film that she wants to go and watch. And also John Hughes's Home Alone. Which I love the idea of
Which
Oland
is always
watching
good, right?
Home Alone.
Yeah,
always good.
I like
always,
that.
Always good. And Elif Safak will be watching Brazil. Brilliant film. Right. You have some music.
Terry Gilliam's Nuts film.
Yes,
of course.
It's bonkers.
Yeah. That's good, isn't it?
Yes,
I didn't see that. Well, I did see that. But...
And perhaps as it might inspire me to go out and get Brazil to watch over the Christmas period as well.
Some people, do you think they're lying though? Because some people are all
about
watching
clever stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Clever
care.
Stuff and cool stuff.
Like Paolo Ricci, who's the DJ from Tresor Records in France. He's going to be watching Le Charme Discret de la Bourgeoisie by Louis Buñuel.
He's all going to be reading Les Fleurs du Mal by Charles Baudelaire.
I bet he's going to be watching The Great Escape like everyone else.
We should ring him.
Yeah.
We should ring him, and he won't be reading Les Fleurs du Mal by Charles. Well, if he is, I think he's marvellous. You have some music for us.
I do have some music.
That's not in the magazine.
This is a new thing from Toronto. They're called Snowblink. They're a duo. They're not fresh, but this album is new. It's called Inner Charms, I think. I'm doing this from memory because I failed to bring the disc with me,
That's
as you can
fine.
See. And the song, it's got a great quality to it, and it's got a very optimistic title. The name of the song is called Unsurfed Waves.
Thank you.
And that was Snowblink, the choice of our culture editor, Robert Bound. You're listening to Midori House. Time now to visit our soft power survey, because all this week on Monocle 24, we've been looking at soft power, which is the focus of the latest December-January issue of Monocle magazine. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck sat down with Jonathan McClory, the strategy advisor for place branding and policy at Wink Creative, as well as John Warne, who's director of strategy for the British Council.
How has it come to pass that the UK has managed to claim the top spot?
Well, I think the UK has always done very well in the survey. And I think we look at some really kind of deep embedded things about soft power, some things which probably don't change. You know, so the nature of what people think about Brazilians or what people think about Thai people is quite deep rooted. And that's not going to change with the seasons. But there is no doubt that there are some things which are a bit more ephemeral and which you can take advantage of. And one of those big things was definitely the Olympics. Now, obviously, that's a sporting event, but it was what flowed from that. You know, so it was interesting the UK used that very well in the sense of national pride in a way that wasn't really run by the government. It kind of became a self-evolving thing. The cultural things were run alongside the Olympics, you know, which were major. And all of those things also helped benefit, I think, the UK. And just also on a business sense, the Olympics were important because there was a real sense that Britain was bad at infrastructure and that we had, you know, great examples that had done badly for us in the selling of our country and our values overseas. People had seen the Terminal 5 debacle. They'd seen the building of the what's now called the O2. But this idea that we just couldn't do those things. Now, here was an example to the world. It worked out very cleverly at every level, from, you know, sport to building, that actually Britain had a lot to offer and it was very welcoming.
And John, I just wondered, does it make your job easy when you have the gift of something like an Olympic Games, which is such a sort of perfect vehicle to exercise soft power? Does it make it easier when you're touting Great Britain's many cultural offerings to have an event like that at the heart of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was stunning success. As I said just before it, you know, with a slight amount of trepidation, I did an interview on the morning before the opening ceremony for CNN, and I said at that time, "To know us is to love us," and quite frankly, I think everything that followed, you know, completely was beyond my hopes and expectations in terms of a beautifully curated sort of updating, I think, of the national story in the opening ceremony. You know, tremendous build quality. I took my family to the Paralympics and, you know, packed venues, the volunteers, the greeting, you know, the feel good, and also the build quality. To that point you were making about infrastructure, you know, the build quality, it was absolutely spot on. So, you know, even the transport, which was touted beforehand as likely to come grinding to a halt, everything about it went off splendidly. And I think most of all, what it portrayed to the world was, you know, a people, a nation, four nations, in fact, very welcoming, very diverse, very open, and, you know, can put on an absolutely fabulous show. So, yeah, it's made my job a stack easier.
One of the things we are concerned about is, you know, that when we did this survey for the future role of the UK is that there seems to be a bit of a kind of decision taken, well, there has been a decision taken to be much more strict about the controlling of students coming to this country. Now, that's a really important facet of soft power and that welcoming mat for overseas visitors. Do you feel some concern there that is being kind of pulled away?
Yeah, I think we have expressed a concern about that to government. You know, it is a very, very important part of national life in this country. I mean, if your children are on campus, then you know, you tend to be in a international, vibrant campus, and you know, that's talent that's both making a contribution in this country and then, you know, connected to the UK from other very, very significant countries. You know, we're number two destination in the world for Indian students. You know, I think we're a number one destination for US students. So we are overall number two destination in the world for students, full stop. So this is a very, very important national asset for us. So, yeah, we have expressed a concern about it. I think a lot of it is about how it's felt and how it's perceived. So, you know, what we've been able to do, I think, is put across that absolutely, you know, neither the government nor us are negative about bona fide foreign students. They're absolutely essential, and the welcome mat is still there. So a concern, but you know, we're coping.
I mean, it's interesting, we described that asset, that attractiveness to students. In terms of the management then of these assets that Britain seems to have indisputably, how concerned are you, Jonathan? I mean, looking to the future, obviously, that we're looking at possibly the legacy of austerity in the years to come, some of the great institutions that Britain has relied upon, you know, the Foreign Office or the BBC, which are facing cuts. Do you think there's an issue with Britain being able to maintain this kind of influence if we see those kind of cuts in the years ahead?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's one of the themes that comes out of the wider research of the Soft Power Index, is that Western countries in general are, you know, by and large going through a period of austerity. And unfortunately, the line items for public diplomacy are pretty easy to cut. It's hard to find strong defenders of that. And of course, the British Council is dealing with, was it 18% cuts or thereabouts? And
26.
Sorry, I didn't mean to shortchange you. And then, of course, the World Service as well is completely restructuring the way they're funded. And that's a very real challenge. And I was actually surprised when we were looking at the audience figures. I would have thought those audience figures would have started to dip a bit already with the World Service. They've been resilient so far, even though they've cut some shortwave broadcasting. But going forwards, I'm definitely concerned about how the UK keeps up that position.
I mean, could I just give you a couple of grounds for cautious optimism, though? In that, I think, you know, a lot of the soft power paradigm is about the power of attraction, and that is as true for cultural institutions and educational institutions, in fact, as it is for nations. So, you know, to some extent, I think one of the big dividends of 2012 is that a lot of cultural institutions came together to pool their resources and pool their assets to actually have a, you know, bigger bang for the collective buck. So I do think that one of the benefits, I think one of the things we do quite well in the UK is that we have a broad range of institutions and brands that we work with, Premier League, you know, obviously all of the great cultural and educational institutions. So there's a good sized team. And there's a decent degree of entrepreneurship as well, which means that, you know, to some extent, we are in austerity. Everyone is under pressure. But there are a hell of a lot of other resources you can attract to your nation's business. You know, there's international donors. There are multinationals. We have big partnerships with Microsoft, HSBC. So, you know, I think when times get hard, it's the time to get entrepreneurial. And it's also the time for teamwork.
And that was Jonathan McClory and John Warne of the British Council talking to Monocle's Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck about soft power. The time is just coming up to 5 minutes before the top of the hour, and you're listening to Midori House. Now, the world's focus may temporarily be elsewhere in the Middle East, but in Iran, the situation remains as ever one of increased financial desperation. As perhaps as a result of these dire straits, there is discord at the top. Parliament summoned President Ahmadinejad. They wanted, it is believed, to call him to account over the economy and other perceived weaknesses. However, the Supreme Leader has now stepped in. The Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has put a stop to the President's summons and has told the legislature, judiciary and executive to behave themselves. Well, to explain how this dispute is affecting the Iranian nation, we're joined now by Mehrad Vayazinajan, who's an Iranian journalist. Welcome, Mehrad. In a case of a crisis like this, economic, this is so grave. Is this a situation of the left arm now trying to stab the right in the back, trying to stab the right?
The main thing which has come out of this whole thing is showed people that who was really in charge, that the Supreme Leader, I mean, he tries his best not to intervene directly in any other issue. I mean, but the fact that he had to come straight and tell people that you have to stop, and as you said, you have to behave, it shows how grave the situation is, and he's trying his best to avoid any sort of real discord at the top. I mean, otherwise, in other examples, he doesn't interfere directly in these matters. He just says some indirect words so that they know what he really wants. But this time, the dispute between the parliament and the executive branch, the government was so serious that he thought it was wiser to come directly in. And this, people can felt that the problem this time is really serious.
What I find astonishing is that the Supreme Leader cited that to see this amount of discord within Iran would be what the foreign enemy sought. Is there a sign now that there's a mindfulness of the outside world, and how vulnerable are the Iranians now economically?
It definitely is a major thing in his mind, or in the Iranian government mind, because the sanctions are hitting the Iranian government hard, and obviously it's hitting the people harder. And what they realize is that he and the whole system is in a very precarious situation, if I can say. So what they want to do is to avoid any sort of representation that there is problem at the top. So we can see that. I mean, he said a word actually which was very interesting. He used the word treason, and he said that to make public these disputes between different branches of the government amounts to treason, which is a very, very strong word to use. And this is because they're in a very difficult times economically, and they want to say that, okay, is that maybe there are problems, there are troubles, but this is nothing to do with us. This is not something from within. All these troubles are being imposed on us by the Westerners, and all these sanctions by the US, by the Europe. So to show that to prove that there is no problem within, he wants to silence different factions within the Islamic Republic who are fighting.
Mehmed Bahuzinejan, Iranian journalist and commentator, as ever, thank you very much indeed for coming on the show. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks to our producer, Aled John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next, after the news, is this week's episode of The Urbanist with our editor, Andrew Tuck. And in 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 hours here in London, Dominic Reynolds and Nancy Durham will be back to bring you The Monocle Daily. And Nancy will be back again in the hot seat for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson, thank you for listening. Goodbye.